Today I'm going to tell you how we made the production Google web search indexing system significantly faster by using incremental processing. So when you hear me say indexing, you're probably thinking of building an inverted index from keywords to a list of URLs. But that's actually the last step in a long process. The process begins with a raw copy of the web, which I've represented in miniature here on the left of the slide, and it ends with a set of documents that are ready to be sent to our serving system. There's a couple things we have to do to finish this transformation. First, we have to eliminate all duplicates. You can see here we've crawled a copy of times.com and nyt.com, which are actually the same website. Only one of those appears in our processed output. We also have to, for example, invert links. We want to move links, anchors, from the pages they point from to the pages they point to. And note that operations like link inversion must obey dupe elimination. So we get a link to or from nyt.com, which is a dupe eliminated site. It's the one we didn't choose. We still have to credit that link to times.com. So indexing the web is something that fits really well into the MapReduce framework. So let's talk about actually how to do duplicate elimination in particular with MapReduce. So we take our collection of documents, we run them through our map, and the map will organize them by, say, content checksum. Then we use our reduce function to pick one of those documents, and we end with a duplicate eliminated copy of the web. That's just duplicate elimination. If we want to build an entire indexing system, we can chain together several of these map reduces to produce the final system. So that's great, but it's not like we index the web, turn off the data center, and go home. We're continually crawling documents. So let's see what happens the next day. We've got this collection of documents we indexed yesterday. We call that the repository. We've also got some new documents that we crawled in the meantime. We call it the refresh. So for each of these documents in the refresh, we've got to decide, should this document be the index or not? Basically, is this document a dupe of something we've already seen before? And to do this with MapReduce, we have to process all the documents in the repository again. That sounds like it's a lot of work, but MapReduce is very scalable. We have a large number of machines, and it's actually practical to do this. And in fact, this is how Google generated its web search index before the work described in this paper. So now that we know how indexing works, or at least one way to do it, we can step back and think about what is it we want from an indexing system. Well, first we want a large repository of documents. The number of documents in our repository puts an upper bound on the size of our index. If it's not in that repository, we certainly can't serve it to you. Even if we choose not to serve some documents in the repository, the more documents we have there, the higher quality index we'll produce. For instance, we get more links, which we can use to improve ranking. We'd also like a small delay between the time we crawl a document and the time we index it. We call that freshness. So our MapReduce indexing system worked well. It had a very large repository. But as that repository grew, and as the indexing system became more complex and we added more and more MapReduces, we ended up with a system that took us days to go from crawling to indexing. Certainly not desirable. So we can improve this by indexing things incrementally. The way we're going to do incremental indexing, we take all our documents, put them in a big table. And in particular, we're going to build indices in that table and some important columns, for instance, the checksum column. Then when a new document arrives, we can do a lookup in our index on checksum, write some new state into the table, do a couple reads, and send that document immediately off to serving, one at a time. Certainly going to lower our delay between crawling and indexing. Let's see how that might look in action. So I have two tables here. The table on the top is what we call a document table. It represents general information about a document. So we see the URL nyt.com, it's page rank. We'd also have the body here, language, etc. We also have a side table, represent the bottom of the slide, and this maps from content checksums to the current best document for that checksum. We call it the canonical document. This is our index, essentially. So in the beginning of the world, only nyt.com is in the index. But say we crawl nytimes.com. This is a better known URL for the New York Times website. So there's a higher page rank. Maybe we'd prefer to choose this document as the canonical for the Times website. So to do that, we go to our index, we erase nyt.com, we add nytimes.com. And we also have to mark the bit in the document table that says whether or not this is a canonical. So this bit is important because it actually determines whether or not the document ends up in the index. So nyt.com, no longer the index, nytimes.com is in the index. So everything worked out great there. What happens if we process both of these URLs simultaneously? Depending on the order these reads are interlaced, we could get a situation where neither document's in the index, obviously bad, or both are in the index. That's also problematic. Users really don't like to see duplicates in their search results. This example is somewhat transient. We crawl New York Times all the time. We'll probably fix this. You can imagine other scenarios where it can actually permanently damage the repository by interleaving writes badly. So to solve this problem, Percolator provides distributed transactions on top of Bigtable. So here's what our duplicate clustering example might look like written out in Percolator. We declare a transaction. We're going to get, say, the raw contents out of some table where we've stashed them prior to processing, do a little work, and eventually we'll come to the point where we want to update that index from checksum to document. And here's where we're going to conflict if someone's simultaneously running on the same checksum. So this avoids the bad interleaving. One of these documents, one of these transactions will abort. That document will not appear in the index. So notice this, the transaction API here is pretty simple. You get get, set, commit, and you can do simple iterations. We also have limited support for secondary indices. So I'm going to tell you a little bit how we implement these distributed transactions. But first, I'm going to give you a little background on Bigtable. Bigtable is a sorted row, column, timestamp store. I'm going to represent it as a table here. And in lieu of providing you 3D glasses, I'll represent the third timestamp dimension as these numbers within each cell. So you can see the cell at row 1, column 1 has something stored at timestamp 1, row 1, column 2 has something stored at timestamp 2. Bigtable partitions data into row ranges called tablets, and it spreads those tablets across many machines. That's important because it means if a transaction spans two rows, it could potentially span machines, and we have to implement distributed transactions. So Percolator provides snapshot isolation transactions. It's a multi-version protocol which maps very neatly to the timestamp dimension in Bigtable. Our basic approach is to make a two-phase commit coordinated by the client. Now, the first phase of this commit is going to be acquire locks and all the cells we wish to write. The second phase will be to release those locks and commit. So one big question is where are we going to store these locks? Well, the locks need to be persistent. If a machine failed and the lock was lost, we could incorrectly allow two transactions that would otherwise conflict to commit. And the lock service needs to be very scalable, too. Every transaction needs to read these locks. So we need to get very high throughput. Persistent, scalable, and reliable are things that all describe Bigtable. So we actually store these locks in Bigtable itself. So for a given user-visible column in Percolator, say a simple banking example, we might have a column called balance, actually maps to three columns in the underlying Bigtable. Now, the first one's called a data column. It contains, as you might guess, data. Now, the second is the commit column. The commit column contains a record indicating, first, where to find the data in the data column, namely what timestamp to find the data at, but more importantly, that this data is committed and should be visible to future reads. And finally, we have the lock column, which indicates to other writers that this cell is locked by the current holder of the column. So let's walk through an example of how commit works in Percolator. So here's a very simple transaction where Alice is stealing $5 from Bob and transferring to her account. So at the beginning of time, there's $10 in both Alice and Bob's account. You can see the data in the data column there, and the commit records indicating the data is visible to other readers. So Alice begins by locking one of the columns she's going to write. She starts with her column. And while she writes this lock column, she first has to check to see if there's any other locks present. If there are, she's found a conflict, and she should abort. In this case, she's fine, so she writes her lock. Then she proceeds to write a lock in Bob's column, the other column she's going to write. Now that she succeeded in doing both, she can commit. She is not required to commit at this point, but she may commit. And she does so by erasing locks and adding commit records. At this point, she's past the commit point, so she must roll forward here and finish the transaction. So hopefully I've given you a little flavor of how transactions work in Percolator. But transactions alone aren't enough to build applications. We have this extra problem of figuring out what work needs to be done. The abstraction that Percolator provides to help us with this problem is something called notifications. So notifications allow users to register a small bit of code that will be invoked any time a given column is written. When the piece of code is invoked, we provide you with a transaction. And when the piece of code, the observer, exits, the transaction will be committed. We guarantee to run observers at most once per write. It may be that there are multiple writes before your observers run. That's a feature, not a bug. You can tell because I gave it a name. It's called message collapsing. And this is great for cells that get written a lot. It's probably not necessary to redo all the work for Google.com every time someone adds a new link to it, but just to do it periodically. So given notifications, Percolator applications end up being structured as a series of observers. So in this example, at the bottom of the slide, the raw document loader writes some column that the document processor observer reads. And the document processor, in turn, writes columns that the document exporter and the link inverter observe, so those observers are then triggered. Hopefully your your graph of observer dependencies looks like a tree, if there's any cycles, that could be a problem. So how do we implement notifications? We're going to add another special column to our big table. This is a dirty column. And if there's a bit in this dirty column, it indicates that observers should be run for that row. So if we write something in a row, we also toggle the dirty bit. Then we can do a randomized distributed scan over the dirty bit to find pending work and to run the observers in a big thread pool. So you might think I've traded one global scan from another, but Bigtable can make this scan very efficient because it stores sparse sets efficiently. So the nice thing about this setup, there's no map shards or anything equivalent. There's no work units, so there's nothing to straggle. That's not to say we don't have long transactions. We do have long transactions. But a long transaction doesn't hold up anybody else in the way, say, that a long reduce shard prevents a map reduce from finishing and the next one from starting. So we've been talking about computer science for a while here. I thought I'd give us a little break and talk about some public transportation infrastructure. So you may have observed that you're waiting for a bus and nothing happens for a long time, and then all of a sudden three buses arrive. It's not the case that you're unlucky or that the MTA is out to get you. This is, in fact, inevitable. And what happens is that one bus is rolling along, and for some reason it gets slowed down. So there's a lot of people to load, somebody's fumbling for change, the bus gets slowed down. But people keep arriving at the stops in front of that bus. So when the bus gets to the next stop, it takes even longer to load people, it's slowed down further, et cetera. As you can see, that the bus just continues to get slower. On the other hand, the buses behind that bus have very little work to do. All the people they would have picked up are now on the crowded slow bus. So the trailing buses end up clumping with the front bus. And this is exactly what happened when we implemented this randomized distributed scan. Some of the scanners would get stuck in regions of the table because the work there was hard, or simply because there was a lot of work. And they would end up overloading tablet servers and slowing down and clumping together. And this reduced our effective parallelism. So we took an approach that your average public transportation provider can't. We detect when two scanner threads are right on top of each other. We do this with a lightweight lock service. And if they notice this, if they notice they're in a clump, they jump to a new location in the table. This is sort of the equivalent of buses teleporting to a new stop when they notice they're right behind another bus. So just to give you a picture of what the system looks like at a higher level, on each machine, represented here by the dotted box, we take the percolator library, and we link it with all the observer code, with all of your observers. We also run a tablet server and a GFS chunk server in every machine. And the percolator library sends RPCs to Bigtable to satisfy the transactions that are running inside the observer code. Tablet servers, in turn, talk to GFS. So I've given you a little flavor of how our system's implemented. I thought I'd spend the rest of the time talking about some of our experiences with building a big incremental system. So this is the graph of the performance of our system. The y-axis says how many documents we did per day relative to a performance target that we set for ourselves. The x-axis is time. You might notice the x-axis is a little bit unusual and the time is in months. So it was a little bit of a struggle to get the system going, and I thought I'd share with you some of the trials and tribulations we had to go through. So the first problem we had was that this system imposes a very different access pattern on our hardware. Whereas MapReduce issues streaming reads to disk, large RPCs, you know, it sends one RPC and gets a huge number of documents from GFS, our system's just the opposite. To process one document, sends many small RPCs, which draws many small random disk IOs. So even though MapReduce, we saw it did this extra work with these global scans, it does so very efficiently because it's so well-tuned to our infrastructure. So we designed a synthetic experiment to explore the effect of these different access patterns. In this experiment, we're simulating the duplicate elimination that I explained earlier. The MapReduce system works by scanning over a collection of documents to find duplicates. The percolator system works by maintaining an index. The y-axis here shows how long it took on average to duplicate eliminate a document. The x-axis shows fraction of the repository refreshed per hour, which is a complicated way of saying how fast documents arrived at the system. So let's examine a point here on the left. This corresponds to a very small number of documents arriving per unit time. In the percolator system, we do a couple lookups in our index tables. We send the document out to serving. We can do this in less than a second. For the same workload in MapReduce, even though the refresh is very small, MapReduce still has to process the entire collection of documents, which in this case was several terabytes of data. So you can see it takes over 2,000 seconds to do so. As we move to the right and add more and more documents arriving per unit time, percolator's performance stays relatively flat until something very dramatic happens here in around 35%. What happens here is that we simply overload the resources of the cluster. In particular, the Bigtable chunk servers, the Bigtable tablet servers became CPU bound and could no longer process our requests. At this point, queues started to build up, and the effective average throughput elimination time went to infinity. MapReduce, on the other hand, is growing very slowly. At the 40% refresh rate, MapReduce essentially has to process 1.4 times as much input as it did at the zero refresh rate. You might think it should run 1.4 times as slow, but in fact, the runtime is somewhat limited by stragglers, so the correlation isn't as strong. Now, MapReduce would eventually run into the same problem that Perclator did. Eventually, that MapReduce will take more than an hour to finish, and queues will build up, and the latency will spike to infinity. But that happens off the right side of this graph. So what can we learn from this? Well, our indexing system can't possibly refresh something like 40% of the web a day. We actually operate way towards the left corner of this graph. We refresh a very small part of the web every day, which means that we can use Perclator and obtain very low latency. It also means that if you have a huge fraction of your data to reprocess every day, or if you're only going to process your data once, MapReduce may be a more appropriate system. So that's a quantitative view of using MapReduce versus Perclator. Let me tell you a little bit about our more qualitative experiences. On the plus side, after switching the indexing system from MapReduce to Perclator, our freshness really did improve. The indexing delay dropped from something like days to something like minutes. And the system is really scalable in a couple ways. If you want to process more documents per day, if you want your throughput to be higher, you can just buy more CPUs. I think this is why my manager really likes this. It's much easier to write checks than to get engineers to optimize systems. And this is something you really can't do with MapReduce. If you have a MapReduce and you add twice as many cores, it's probably not going to go twice as fast, again, due to stragglers. We also need to make our repository a lot bigger. It's currently limited only by the disk space available in our cell. And that's, again, because we don't have to map over it every time we do an operation. We also make really good use of our hardware at this system. MapReduce imposes kind of a spiky workload on our cluster. It gets really busy at first, but then as the map stage is finishing, most of the machines are idle. This system is very smooth utilization, so we're able to achieve, we'll keep our machines busy all the time. On the downside, it's a bit harder to use this system. MapReduce is a great interface, and you don't really have to think about concurrency like you do in a Perclator-based system. We did give application developers transactions, which helps somewhat, but they still have to reason about concurrency and reason about transactions, which is more work. It's also somewhat more expensive to process a document Perclator. It's only a factor of about two, however. Another odd decision we made, which I thought it might be of interest to the community, is we decided to use many threads to implement Perclator. So each transaction actually runs in a thread, its own thread, and does blocking operations. So in order to obtain good throughput, we run many threads per machine. We run thousands of threads on commodity Linux machines. On the plus side, it's that application developers write straight line code. No one likes currying up their state manually into callbacks. And we get meaningful stack traces, which aid debugging and performance profiling. And it's really easy to get scalability on many core machines. We always have runnable threads, so if we get more cores, we just use them. On the downside, Linux kind of broke the first time we tried this. Just one example, Linux was holding a lock, the mmap semaphore, while it was doing some operation on every thread. And that operation took long enough that the machine was essentially locked up long enough to be evicted from our cluster. We also built what I think is a really good detector for thread local storage. Most people who use thread local storage are thinking about threads proportional to the number of CPUs, not in the thousands, so we frequently had problems with memory. We also did chase down some lock contention on global data structures like caches, but that was mostly easily dealt with. So let me pause here to give you a little bit of philosophy that I've developed while building this system. And this comes from a gentleman you might recognize. This is former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. It says something I think is kind of poetic. He said, there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know. So he was talking about war, of course, but I think this applies equally to building large systems. And all those problems I just told you about, seeks, running too many threads on Linux, that's kind of a known unknown. I knew that would probably be a problem, and we can do some back-end build calculations and figure out if we're going to survive or not. But I'd like to talk about some unknown unknowns, things that really came out of left field. I don't start with these because they're so technically deep, or the solutions are that interesting, just because it's the kind of stuff that maybe you wouldn't have thought of. I certainly didn't. So here are some examples. We have a few CPUs in our cell that periodically get the XOR wrong. This makes it look like our files are being randomly corrupted because we see checksum failures just across a whole selection of files. The files are fine, it's just the machine needs to be taken out and shot. We also had some problems with scaling Bigtable. We made our Bigtable cell, it's by far the largest in the company. And it's little pieces that fail. For instance, it was the garbage collector in Bigtable that failed. Bigtable creates files periodically, and it couldn't delete them fast enough. When we looked at the, I told you Sikhs were a known unknown, but where those Sikhs were coming from was something unknown unknown. It turned out that over 50% of our Sikhs were going to useless read-ahead and metadata. It's similar to what the Haystack guys talked about yesterday. We ended up switching to ext4 to get the extent-based file system to fix this. We also had a problem where an incorrectly specified resistor on our motherboard from a batch of machines caused our workload and only our workload to power machines off. So, definitely an unknown unknown. I wish I had some advice on how to avoid all of these, but I'll say a couple things. In these really deeply layered systems, which I think is sort of the future of complicated systems, certainly the layering here helped us actually implement this, it's important to push performance debugging through all layers of the system. When I'm trying to optimize Sikhs, how many Sikhs our application is doing, it's not sufficient to look at how many Bigtable reads I'm doing. I really had to get sort of down as close to the metal as possible and end up looking at like the source code to ext2. Finally, I think that the sort of weirdness you expect, like the CPUs getting X or wrong, is proportional to machine count. 1,000 machine systems are definitely weirder than 100 machine systems. I don't know if they're 10 times weirder, but definitely more of that crops up. So in conclusion, Percolator is building the caffeine web search index. This is the index you're using right now instead of listening to me talk. The results are about 50% fresher. We made indexing dramatically faster, but it's not the only bottleneck to getting results out to serving. So by removing our bottleneck, results are about half as delayed as they were previously. We also made our repository about 3 times larger. And finally, I think this system is interesting because it's something of existence proof that it's possible to build distributed transactions at web scale. So thanks for your time. I'll take any questions.
Mehul Shah, HP Labs. So can you talk a little bit about the limits of your system? Two limits that I'm interested in.
Sure.
So one limit I'm interested in is how much concurrency can it actually support before the model that you're using for transactions starts to break down?
Mm-hmm.
And the second limit that I'm interested in is sort of, you know, how many things can be waiting on notifications before things start to, again, break down? Could you have loops in your notifications where,
sure.
Yeah, so on. Thanks.
Okay, the first one, concurrency. It's definitely a problem if several writers end up writing to the same cell. You know, we have to do a sort of an optimistic backoff in that case. It's an exponential backoff. There's no global deadlock detector or anything like that. So that's actually one of the more severe limitations of the system. Application developers have to be very careful not to introduce what we call write hotspots. We do tend to see those. For instance, we'll crawl a whole bunch of MySpace pages that all redirect to some one login page, and we'll really pound that one page. So it's a bit of a trade-off. With a distributed system this big, we can't afford to have some of those centralized components. And one of those is the global detector that might make that more efficient. It hasn't been a huge problem because we're more interested in throughput than latency. So if a few transactions take forever, it's not a big deal for us. You asked about notifications queuing up.
Yeah.
We actually store the notifications in Bigtable itself. So it's not a problem. We're not gonna run out of space storing bits in Bigtable.
Okay. One more follow-up.
Sure.
What do you do about clients that leave locks kind of sitting around and
sure.
So on?
I think I might have a slide for that.
Yeah.
Okay. We do a lazy cleanup. So if a client fails, yeah, he could leave locks on the table. And the next person that comes along and wants to write that cell has to clean the lock up. So it's a little bit of the tricky part is you might worry that while I'm cleaning up the transaction, the committer is actually still alive and trying to commit. So they both have to do a read, modify, write on a prearranged rendezvous point to make sure that only one of them actually succeeds in either the cleanup or the commit.
Thanks.
No problem.
Dave Koch, Nictor and USW. So this looks interesting principally in terms of, sort of the scale it's operating at.
Mm-hmm.
is clearly an interesting thing. But so as I watch you sort of develop the ideas, it's looking more and more like a sort of concurrent DBMS, and you know your triggers look like database triggers, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So to what extent is there sort of novelty here in the system you've built, like with respect to existing DBMS systems? And to what extent is it just the scale it's operating at that's the novelty, or is there really new work here?
Well, I think you've identified correctly the novelty, which is scale. I mean, I don't claim to have invented snapshot isolation. I read a lot of database papers from the 80s and, you know, crib the snapshot isolation algorithm.
So the real novelty is that you're operating at an enormous scale. And
yeah, I mean, I think practical. It's something that the field sort of gave up on, right, is running distributed transactions at a really huge scale. So I think it's interesting that it's at least possible.
I'm Derek Murray, University of Cambridge. Did you consider adding an incremental processing or memoization layer, like a Nectar from yesterday, to MapReduce? And what do you think the performance and cost trade-offs would have been like if you'd done that?
Yeah, that's interesting, because Nectar and us are sort of getting at the same thing, right? We recognize that we're doing a lot of the same work over and over again. We're scanning this repository. Yeah. I hadn't thought about adding it to this system. The system's motivated by avoiding a lot of needless work already. So, but you're right, it might be possible to optimize it further. We do take some minor advantage of this. If two transactions on the same machine are reading the same row, we do things like only send one RPC and share the results. So
it seems like stragglers might have been an issue, and I don't know if you can comment on what the causes of stragglers in these workloads would be.
Oh, like long transactions?
Long transactions. I mean, well, when you had the MapReduce-based version, what was causing straggling?
Oh, in MapReduce?
Yeah.
Machine failures, process failures generally. Just get an unlucky reduced shard that's almost done and then crashes. You got to start all over.
Great. Thank you.
Mike Friedman, Princeton. I guess I have a question. It's more of a looking for a response. But it seemed like talking about what you were looking at what you were talking about at the end, it was about lessons about building these complex layered systems. And it seemed like a lot of the errors that you picked up on were either things that resulted in crash failures or somewhat bugs like the XOR that were then masked as crash failures or performance stutters. Mm-hmm. And your lesson was about going down to more and more to the bare metal in order to do debugging, which I totally understand. On the flip side, kind of there's this lesson about wanting to have failure decoupling in distributed systems, or now we're moving to maybe not Google, but lots in more virtualized environments. So I wonder how you might think that these two things, both these two opposing views kind of relate to one another, or if they were perhaps failures that made this very difficult that weren't really crash or performance blips that you could live with, but perhaps not achieve that, you know, great performance that you actually end up looking for.
Hmm. Well, I guess you could argue that it's a failure of the Bigtable abstraction that I had to look, you know, all the way down to the disk to figure out what was going on. Whether or not you could mask that with a virtualization layer, I don't know. I mean, we're so worried about efficiency. I mean, fundamentally, it's a very, very cheap company. So we really want to run these machines as hard as possible. So I worried that any kind of masking would have an overhead that would be unacceptable. But if it wasn't, we could certainly consider it.
Margo Seltzer from Harvard University. Yeah. So I'm assuming you're familiar with the great MapReduce debate versus Stonebreaker and DeWitt.
Yes, of course.
So I, you know, the whole time you're giving the talk, the back of my head, it's like, you know, okay, we're Stonebreaker and DeWitt, right? And part of me is thinking, you know, there's this, you know, the database guys are now trying to say, well, we can build a hybrid MapReduce distributed database, and I really am curious what your thoughts are on this.
Well, I mean, I think they were right about one important thing, which is, if you try to pretend MapReduce is a database, it's not a very good one. So indices are a really great thing. And I think that was my main takeaway from Stonebreaker's paper, and I think he was definitely right about that. I certainly don't want to say that MapReduce is dead. I mean, there are a handful of users of this system, one obviously important one, in Google, and still thousands of users of MapReduce. So.
Brian Ford, Yale. This is really cool and interesting. You alluded to one detail I thought was might be interesting. You mentioned the danger of having like cycles of observer cycles, right, or things like that. Is that a situation you found yourself getting into accidentally, for example, because of false dependencies, circular dependencies between, you know, different things stored in the same rows or other situations? Is that a problem, and how do you deal with that?
I think we did it exactly once, and we've just been vigilant since then. It's something the system doesn't check automatically, so we do rely on the...
So what happens? Does it blow up with some kind of...
No, in fact, it ran for overnight. It just the system was busy, it looked healthy, except the work wasn't getting done, so nothing tragic, but nothing good either.
Thanks.